Well, welcome to Mockingbird the Movies. I'm Nick.
See?
Here we go. See? Nice. We got a few more seats in the front. I don't know where we're going to look. Maybe we can all scoot closer. Church Van Vorst in Jersey City, New Jersey, which is, though it's close to here as the crow flies, it's very far, and it's sort of New York, New Jersey split. I wanted to say two things sort of off the top. The first is that I think this can be not a dangerous thing, but it can become sort of like an idol in your preaching if you do that, or it in your examples. I do movie examples because I like movies. And if you don't, then it's not going to work for you. If you like rock and roll, use that. If you like TV, use that. If you like soccer, use that. I mean, this works for me, so this is what I do. I use movies that I like. I don't have a sermon that I have to write and watch movies trying to find examples for that sermon. I watch movies every night, and so when I'm thinking of a sermon, that's sort of where my brain goes. So I guess all I'm trying to say is that I'm not sure, in fact, I'm pretty sure that this sort of thing can be forced. That do what you like, and that's what you got to do. The last thing I want to say before we get officially started is that movies are not the gospel. They are a way, maybe, of explaining the gospel, or of providing a window into what is the gospel. Come on in, guys. There's a few chairs left. There we go. Looks like this is about the right amount of chairs. So, we can get sort of maybe even a little too caught up in our examples and forget what it is they're examples of, what it is we're actually trying to explain. So, I don't think that Frasier is a great, show because it's about the gospel, but I think that, as we'll see in a minute, Frasier has something to say about what life is like. And that's really, I see the movies that I really like and the ones that I tend to return to over and over again are the ones that I feel are really true to life. And so that's, I guess, the caveats. I wanted to jump right in and show a clip right off the top. In terms of format, I've done this sort of thing at my church, but my church likes to sit and listen to me talk. I would prefer that not to be the case. So please interrupt, ask questions, make comments, suggest other movies that if I was smart enough I would have seen. I really want this to be as collaborative a thing as we can. But I have lots of stuff, so let's jump right into the first clip and then we'll start to discuss it.
The winner of a $30,000 scholarship is Miss Louisiana Erica Schwartz. And the new Miss America is Miss Kansas, Tara Dawn Holland. Scholarship is Miss Louisiana
kinds of people in this world. Winners and losers. Inside each and every one of you, at the very core of your being, is a winner waiting to be awakened and unleashed upon the world. With my 9-step refuse to lose program, you now have the necessary tools and the insight and the know-how to put your losing habits behind you to go out and make your dreams come true. No hesitating. No complaining. No excuses. I want you to go out in the world. I want you to be winners.
That was some of its impact.
Yeah.
Maybe we won't be able to go full screen, but we'll figure it out. So that is the opening. The opening scenes from Little Miss Sunshine.
I'll fix it. I'll figure it out. Sure.
Thanks, RJ.
No problem.
Mastery.
I'll try.
So I'm not 100% sure it's the projector. It might be some sort of. Let's just ignore the man behind the curtain.
That's right.
So this starts to illustrate the sort of the human problem that we have. Greg Kinnear, the motivational speaker, talking about how there are two kinds of people in the world. There are winners and losers, and I think that while this is sort of laughable, it's very real. Real to human experience. We would never probably risk writing a self-help program like that because we're fearful that we fall into the loser half or 85%. The law, as we know, says that we must be winners. Girl at the beginning of the clip is watching the results of Miss America, and her law is to be beautiful, and she's imitating, she's smiling, she's waving. She has this law presented to her in a very, non-verbal way. It's just the existence of a standard, whereas Greg Kinnear is thinking about sort of these ultimate winners and winning and losing of life, but when they reveal who he's making this, you imagine as you see him from the side that he's in a giant auditorium, with hundreds of executives, mm-hmm. And when they show it, it's this tiny classroom with a few high schoolers. So the winning is even in this brief clip shown to be a little bit more elusive than his 9 steps might have led him to think, because one would imagine that he would be a devoted follower of his own 9 steps and that he might be a little bit more successful. So this is sort of the first salvo in the artillery of the human problem. We are presented with requirements, whether we apply them to ourselves, like Abigail Breslin does, or have people like Greg Kinnear apply them to us. We find ourselves in constant reactivity to these things. I want to show the next thing, but I can tell that it's not.
Do you want to try my computer?
I can do about 5 minutes. You want me to switch it up?
But the clips are on my computer.
On a disk, or do you do this?
Well, they're on a disk, but I haven't tried it. These are just files on the computer.
Okay.
The files are in the computer.
That's right.
That's a good reference.
But Nick, I just want to say with that's helpful, I think, in terms of the ministries. You can say, but compared to Jesus Christ, we're all losers, and we need salvation. But to show an image like that, in a setting like that, people can say, you know, they know of Greg Kinnear. They know times when they've heard somebody who's gotten excited about, I'm finally going to get my life back together. Or they've heard, you know, a pastor on the radio. And it's so much more real when you see an image like that, like on the movie screen. Because people can fit themselves into that story better than me just saying, you're actually lost. You know, but them seeing it, like, oh yeah, that's me or that's my uncle.
Nick, was it doing this before your computer went to sleep?
No.
Let's restart the projector and see if that happened.
Yeah, because that's probably
it. It may just be we restart it.
Okay.
That'll take like 2 seconds.
It's funny. I've done this a few times. This always happens. I wish I was exaggerating when I said always. Like, oh, actually, it's only, you know, 30% of the time. It's actually always. I was here earlier, I was afraid to shut it off. So I left it playing the whole time Rod was talking. It was just on a loop. And it was fine. And now...
Do you show these in your, like, adult education hour?
Well, we just did a class called Jesus at the Movies, which was a 7-week class. This is sort of an amalgam of two of those weeks. Epson, they're a
good message,
good company there.
Do you have a syllabus for that 7-week course?
I have an outline. Yeah.
That can be shared.
Sure. Get it to. Mockingbird people. We'll see what we can do there. Alright, let's see here. Now it's all. Doesn't it seem stretched the other way?
Better than.
Alright, that's good.
Square.
Should I try full screen?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Alright, let's see what happens. Are we a prayerful
yes.
lot?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is our next clip.
There you go, RJ.
Thank you.
It's 1:56. That means we've got 3 hours and 4 minutes before the end of today's package sort. That's how long we have. That's how much time we have before this pulsating, accursed, relentless taskmaster tries to put us out of business. Hey, Nikolai, goodness. How are you, kid? Look what you did. You just delivered your very first FedEx package. That deserves something special, like a Snickers bar and... a CD player. And something to listen to, a CD. There, Elvis Presley. 50 million fans, can't be wrong. You all recognize this, don't you? I took the liberty of sending this to myself. I FedExed it before I left Memphis. You probably wonder what could be. What could it possibly be? Is it architectural plans? Maybe technical drawings? Is this a new wallpaper for the bathroom? It is... the clock, which I started at absolute zero and is now at 87 hours, 22 minutes, and 17 seconds. From Memphis, America, to Nikolai in Russia, 87 hours. 87 hours is a shameful outrage. This is just... What if it had been something else, like your paycheck, or fresh boysenberries, or adoption papers? 87 hours is an eternity. The cosmos was created in less time. 87 hours. Fortune
favors.
What are you saying about me?
I tell them what do they expect.
This man, when his truck broke down, he stole a boy's bicycle.
I borrowed it. I borrowed a kid's bike, and I got my packages delivered, and that is what you people are going to have to start doing. You have to start doing whatever it takes, because in 3 hours and 2 minutes now, every one of these packages has to be on the big truck and on its way to the airport. 15 minutes! Crunch time! Crunch time!
So he actually refers to the sin of losing track of time. He refers to the clock as that pulsating, accursed, relentless taskmaster. He might as well be St. Paul, right? This is exactly the kind of language that St. Paul is using about the law. This thing that will not stop. It is inexorable. It is going to be the end of you. It will count down. It will take 87 hours for your package to get from Memphis to Russia, which is, as he says, a shameful outrage. When the clock stops on our quest for righteousness, we are revealed to be a shameful outrage. And this is one of the more overt clips that I've ever seen. I mean, it's impossible to miss the theological implications of what's happening here. I mean, Sigmund Freud, for those of you who know Freud, there's great parallels between Freud's idea of the superego and the law and the clock in this clip, this thing that never stops. The superego always sits in judgment of the ego. And how are you doing? And couldn't you be doing a little better? Couldn't you have delivered this a little faster? There's never a time that's fast enough. You have the impression that the reason Hanks has this job is that no matter what that clock said, he would have said, this is a shameful outrage. He has to get them going faster. There's no, you know what, you're doing fine. I don't need to be here, I'm unemployed. You know, his job has no end. Until you can transmit from America to Russia in no time, there is always 1 second faster. The pulsating, what does he call it? The pulsating, accursed, he hates it. He says it's accursed, and yet it is the thing that he needs to do. So it's sort of like what Rod was saying earlier, that we hate the thing we need. We hate the thing that we find ourselves drawn to, the thing that we imagine gives us our reason for being, this attempt to beat the clock, to get our stuff done, to sort of move forward on the path. We need that so that we can justify ourselves. That's the human impulse, is to self-justify. And a clock is a great way to help us do it. We can do it a little faster than we did it last time. We can, it's like they say about golfers aren't playing each other. They say they're playing the course, but what they're really playing is every other round they've ever played. they're going to do one stroke better, and you're never going to get better than a hole in one. There's no 18 holes in one in a row. Then you're done. then you can retire. But this is the sort of the second thing about the law, is that it never stops. The first thing that we saw in our first clip is that it divides us into winners and losers. And the second thing is that it never stops. And there's no defeating it. It is the inexorable movement of the clock. Stop me. Say something. Don't let me inexorably move forward. Yeah.
I saw a piece on the news just a couple of days ago about Google towns are competing to be the...
My town's one, too.
One town changed its name to Google Colorado to try and solicit the opportunity.
That's just
to be that fastest.
Jersey City, New Jersey. We're applying for that.
I've been reading the Andre Agassi autobiography, Open, which is actually really, it's really good and profound. There's a lot of really, really good stuff in there. But when he brought on Brad Gilbert to be his coach, you know, who had written this book called Winning Ugly, who Brad Gilbert was the opposite of Agassi in that Brad Gilbert had no natural, not no, very, you know, very limited natural ability, but he was sort of wily and he could sort of get the job done, whereas Agassi had all the ability in the world and yet couldn't break through. And the first thing Gilbert said to him was, your perfectionism is killing you. It's just absolutely killing you. You know, you every time you hit the ball, you're trying to hit the perfect shot. But most of the time, what you just need to do is just keep the ball in play and let the other guy beat himself. You know, that was just a totally transformed Agassi's life. It was a total revelation because he'd had this father who was just made him hit 2,500 balls a day, 7 days a week from the time he was 5 years old. You know, and just all had to be perfect. And it of course, he never actually got over it. But just to hear someone say that to him, like, you know, it's actually better if you try not to be perfect. Was incredibly, really good.
So we've got the dividing line of the law, that it's always forcing you onto winner or loser. And then we have the inexorable quality of the law. Now we're going to see our third quality. We're going to watch two clips right in a row from the same film.
Joanna,
yes.
Come here a minute, please.
I'm sorry, I was late. I was having lunch, and
we need to talk about your flair.
Really? I have 15 pieces on.
Okay, 15 is the minimum.
Okay.
Now, you know, it's up to you whether or not you want to just do the bare minimum. Or, well, like Brian, for example, has 37 pieces of flair. Terrific slot.
Okay, so you want me to wear more?
Look, Joanna, people can get a cheeseburger anywhere, okay? They come to Tchotchke's for the atmosphere and the attitude. Okay, that's what the flair is about. It's about fun.
Okay, so more than,
Look, we want you to express yourself. Now, if you feel that the bare minimum is enough, then okay, but some people choose to wear more, and we encourage that, okay? You do want to express yourself, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, great. That's all I...
Okay.
A little bit later. A few days later.
Joanna.
Yeah?
We need to talk. Do you know what this is about?
My flair?
Yeah. Or your lack of flair, because I'm counting and I only see 15 pieces. Let me ask you a question, Joanna. What do you think of a person who only does the bare minimum?
What do I think? You know what, Stan? If you want me to wear 37 pieces of flair like your pretty boy over there, Brian, why don't you just make the minimum 37 pieces of flair?
Well, I thought I remembered you saying that you wanted to express yourself.
Yeah, I know
what's upcoming.
I do want to express myself. Okay, now I don't need 37 pieces of flair to do it. Here's my flair, okay? And this is me expressing myself. I hate this job.
So, this, in my opinion, this is the most nefarious of the qualities of the law. So, the law as presented is, at first, wear 15 pieces of flair. That's the law when she gets hired at the job. Clearly, that's not actually the law. She then, the implication is, the law is really wear 37 pieces of flair. Or express yourself, blah, blah, blah. But what's the actual law here? What's the law as the supervisor actually means it?
You should want to.
Okay.
You're never good enough.
It's always
never
good
enough. Or
he's always better.
Be Brian. Right? He doesn't want her at all. He just wants Brian. So he's the law masquerades as something that we can do. But what it actually is something that is outside even if we were to care, even if she was to sort of wear 37, have a smile on her face, she's still not Brian. The law really is be Brian. And this, because we're sort of in a Lutheran mode here, but Luther had this great illustration where he said that we think of the law as a kitty cat, and we let it out of the cage. And once it gets out of the cage, we realize that it's a lion, and we can't get it back in. So the law as presented seems relatively simple and tame. Wear more flair. That's the law. But it really is something that is so much more, more impossible. Can I say impossibler?
Impossibler.
I'm in the name of the movie.
Office Space. Yeah. So these are the law masquerades as something we can do, which is why we, again and again, think that maybe just in this instance it's okay to reapply it. To our lives. I mean, if you leave here with nothing else, don't think that we're as professional and mature Christians just as susceptible to this sort of reapplication as anyone else. I mean, we who know the law are most often doomed to try to keep it. Right? It would be better, Paul says, where there is no law, there is no transgression. I mean, we are too acquainted almost. We know the rules, and so the urge to say, I did pretty well, is so strong. The urge to say, well, I got it here in 80 hours rather than 87. Or, I wore 58 pieces of flair, Brian, how much do you wear? The urge to self-justify, as I said, is constitutive to the human experience. And so I wanted to sort of show another example of sort of the same thing, the law masquerading as one thing when it's really something much worse in this next clip here.
Can I make one comment?
Yeah, please.
Another thing is her reaction. Because ultimately, when you realize that the law is just taunting you, it leads to despair. I think that's why we cheered. It's because we're like, yeah, that's right. That's
she's licking off the lawgiver.
Yeah,
and that's why our churches are full of those who haven't gone to church in 25 years. Mm-hmm. This is why we leave church, because we see this this supervisor. That's the church, the lawgiver. And when we realize that there's no end to this law-keeping hamster wheel, we flip it off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't go back, ever. We'd still tell our parents we go back. Oh, sure, I'm having my 3-hour quiet time every morning, of course. And I'm in the local, I go to the local Episcopal church near my college, I promise. Yeah. Not that I have any experience.
It's also the law in this situation in the clip is very external. The Brian, who was the other employee, he had the pieces, and you could see it, and he had it, and he was okay. In the church, you can go to the right Bible studies, do the right things, and ostensibly you're okay, given what's being preached at the pulpit. You just do these certain external things, you check it off your list, and you're okay, even though inside you're crumbling, your relationships are in a sham and everything. But we like the physical, because there's some people who like the Brian. It's like, all I have to do, if I can just get that stuff, I'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But
we'll get there.
You almost want the scene to show her come back in the next day with like 1,000 pieces hanging from every part of her body. Is this the exact same scene to happen? You're wearing the more flair, I get that,
right,
you express
right.
yourself, but really,
yeah.
You still have this frown, you're still not what we
exactly.
you're supposed to be.
Yeah. Right. That would be a great scene. Office Space 2.
That's right.
You reflarening.
Get-togethers out here.
The ad said this pool was lagoon-like. There's nothing lagoon-like about it.
Except for maybe the bugs.
There aren't even any plants out here.
What do you call this? Is this not a plant? If you have a problem with the plants, I can always call my landscape architect. Solved.
I mean, I think lagoon, I think waterfall, I think tropical. This is a cement hole.
I have some tiki torches in the garage.
So there's a few things happening here. The first one is a sort of continuation of what we were talking about in the last clip. She imagines that the law is sell this house. But that's just that's fake. The real law is be Buddy Kane. Because, you know, right across the street there's this other house. Another one sold by Buddy Kane, the king of real estate. So she, if you've seen the film, she gets totally wrapped up in sort of his aura, which has nothing to do with who he actually is as a person. He is a construct for her of this idealized, perfect real estate agent who could sell any house, including one with such a crappy pool, right? So then, when she is failure, when she has tried her best and not sold the house, she closes the blinds and starts to cry. And this is sort of the second cut of the two edges of the legal sword, if you will. The first is that it shows her that she's a failure. And then it cuts back, and she hates herself for it. She She can't. She's critical. She's. It's sort of losing my train of thought. It's not enough to see yourself as failing to measure up. You then hate yourself for failing to measure up. So there's one cut, and then it cuts back. And she can't let anybody see. She closes the blinds, which goes back to our first winners and losers clip. She's terrified of the world seeing her as something like a loser. She knows that the king of real estate is a winner. And in order to be like him, she must be a winner too. So she can't show any weakness. So when she has to cry, when she breaks down, she closes the blinds so that no one will see her. And of course, you know, the analog here in Christianity is all the energy that we spend convincing ourselves that we are strong and we don't need saving. When the weaker we are, as Rod said right at the end, you know, Jesus came for the sick. He came for the crappy salespeople. He didn't come for the king of real estate. He came for Carolyn Burnham. So she's, it's almost like three cuts. The failure, the self-loathing, and then the separation from the recognition that it's for failed self-loathers that Jesus came.
Mm-hmm. There's a scene toward the end of Ordinary People where Mary Tyler Moore is confronted by her husband with the complete destruction of their marriage, and she goes up to the bedroom and gets a suitcase out to leave. And it's an extended scene in which she comes that close to breaking down and crying. And it's almost there, sort of salvation. And at the last second, she tightens and leaves her taxi. Awful scene.
Yeah,
very
painful.
I think there's the kind of the added layer of this. I mean, you can't really make something other than what it is. Like, you can clean it up all you want.
Yeah.
You know, it's the phrase "naked and shine turd," but it's still, you know, it's like, I mean, it's, you know, you can have all the quiet times, you can do all the right stuff, you can look the way a Christian is supposed to look, but in the end, you know, we are the self-loathing masses.
Right.
And you're always going to find one more blemish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's always one more spot in the mirror.
Yeah,
there's always one more spot in the mirror.
That's right.
And then try the justification of it, you know, just how she's like, oh, like, I have some tiki torches in
yeah.
there. And she's like, you just need to put a skylight in, and you look at the room and you're like, it's miserable. You know, it's like the justification, but like in the end.
The dream
like,
of any cook.
Yeah, you know. It's like, yeah. Then I think, though, like how we'll all be silent in the end, you know, it's
yeah.
like our sin, we all like justify now, make excuses, but in the end, it's like everyone's mouth, like we won't have any words to say, you know.
And she doesn't either, except hateful
yeah.
words toward herself.
And not just that, but hitting herself
yeah.
to
yeah.
her weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And her
momentary
lapse. And I think it's so comforting that, like, we won't have anything to say, but we have comfort that, like, the grace of God, that He covers us, and that in that moment in the end, that, like, we'll be okay. And He'll love us. And, you know, I think that's where, like, the grace comes in with all this, like, falls.
Well, I mean, we're promised an advocate.
Yeah.
Right? Like, when we have nothing we can say, we're specifically promised a spokesman, you know, who will come in and speak for us, intercede for us with sighs too deep for words. Weakness,
the abusive parent was in there.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw, you know, not on the screen, but she was abusing herself like a parent would abuse a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think of her background. Ends of her becoming that person.
Right.
And 2 Corinthians talks about the Holy Spirit being the comforter that comforts us with the comfort with which we've been comforted.
Yeah.
Comes full circle.
Oh,
yeah.
You got more points to go through.
No, we got plenty of time.
Hurt,
plenty of time.
But I wonder how you, I really like what you're doing, but now I'm from Indianapolis. Well, we settle a lot easier in Indianapolis for different things.
her standard is a little lower than New York City. But
how do you reconcile with the people? I don't know. Is your ministry in New York or somewhere?
Jersey City?
Okay,
Jersey.
Same difference.
Virginia, now, this perspective.
Don't tell New York people.
Yes. from our perspective.
Okay.
But how do you reconcile that? There are like two kinds of righteousness. We are talking here in a very familiar way about a righteousness that we care about very much, which is our righteousness before God, our ailing righteousness. And we talk about the law in such a way that we understand that we cannot be righteous before God, you know, by cleaning up the house a little more. But these same people that we minister to go back to their jobs in real estate or working for FedEx, and those standards matter very much. And how do we avoid telling people, well, you're saved. Now you can be a slob. And you know, if you lose your job over it, and, you know, gee, you're saved.
Right.
You know, so they had the people in the city, especially, as opposed to the country, where I've been a pastor for many years too, and I was a pastor in the jungle for many years. People in the city are really driven by standards that we don't want to completely abjure, but. Do you discuss the reconciliation or how we live with both of those kinds of things?
I would submit, with all due respect, that it's a little bit of a straw man argument, I think, in that I've never met anyone who heard the sort of real freeing word of the gospel and then was excited to live like a slob. I've never experienced that. But I would say, you know, theologically speaking, you know, I would never encourage anyone to do anything that would jeopardize their work. You know, like not deliver. I mean, Jesus doesn't say, you know, don't deliver your packages on time because you don't want to be a slave to the law. You know, there's a. I am sure that I don't want to get very deep into it, but there's first uses of the law, second uses of the law, but maybe that's for another time. But ultimately, I guess what I would have to say is that, I mean, I'm a preacher, and I'm using these things to assure my experience of people is that their work, or their home life, or their friendships. All of these things combine to make them feel like they come down on the loser side of the loser slash winner thing. And if I can tell them that there is something that's there for losers, I believe in the Holy Spirit. And I believe that it's the Holy Spirit's job to counsel, but it's my job to try to cut as many strings as I can, rather than add them. I think that if I can tell somebody, you know, Christ's righteousness is sufficient for you if you get fired tomorrow and can never provide for your family again. I trust that they're not going to go out and quit their job. I think that it's going to actually, counterintuitively, maybe, inspire something, you know, the quote-unquote Protestant workout. I don't know about that. I think you were first in the back.
Can a layman take a shot?
Please.
When I watched her at the end close the curtain, she took all the responsibility on herself.
Yeah.
And I thought, it's not her responsibility to sell the house. It's the house's responsibility to sell it.
Research working on it.
But it's not. No, it's not. I'm sorry. I'm not ignoring this. It's not showing everything.
Okay.
And you shut off the sound. Please keep talking.
And it seemed to me that one of the fourth characteristic of the law in my life is that it always makes me take responsibility. I always have to. It's always my responsibility to be right, to be able to do it. And when I looked at that, it's the house. Now, as a real estate agent, She can help the house along. But she took it all on herself. And the fourth characteristic of the law for me is, I will always take it on myself. I will always turn it on.
In terms of the time analogy, people going back to their work, like when Tom Hanks, you can imagine, Tom Hanks finally understood the power of the law and the power of the gospel, he might actually even be a better boss. He won't steal kids' bikes anymore. He may not have that stress, but it doesn't change him, it doesn't change what he's doing. And I know there's two ladies in our church. One for them...
There's no, I can't stop it. You know, they can't find the pause button.
Oh,
it's not showing.
Space bar.
Space
button. Oh, but now how do I go back?
Use the arrows.
Escape, yeah.
Escape. It's always an escape hatch.
But how much? Okay. But I pause button? Okay. Okay. Look at you, computer knowledge people. Maybe we should start the next clip before it shuts up.
But just say there's two, one person they can't, in terms of the clock, they can't help but be late. No matter whatever they do, they will be 4 minutes late. It's just they can't help it. The other person can't help but be on the clock. It's just like in them. And when they both understood a lot of the power of the law through that and felt free to be like, okay, this is why I am the way I am. But after that, they were still late and the other person was still on time. Man, were they much happier and understanding of the grace of God in that. It doesn't mean it like makes you go crazy or change, but it really is freeing.
Well, and when Luther was asked a similar question, I think he said, he was asked, if you tell people they can do whatever they want, they'll go crazy. And he said, A, they're already going crazy. They're already doing whatever they want. And B, in fact, telling them that they can do whatever they want will actually begin to let them consider what it is they want to do rather than what they're compelled to do. So let's show our next clip, which is we're now going to sort of start moving into the human illusions stuff that I was talking about there, and this is the first one. I turned the volume all the way down, so I'm going to have to turn it up. Sorry if I'm in the way. Will the space bar restart it?
Yeah,
well, it didn't. Oh, wait, I didn't have it on.
Probably did exit again. There you go. Play pause.
This is a quiet one, so I'm not sure how this will work.
I've been out in clubs, I've been out all over the place, and people will come up to me and they'll shake my hand and say,
oh, it's good to see you out. And I like, I look at him like, good to see me out. You know, like, where am I supposed to be? In a closet hanging out?
What I can do, probably people don't think I can do, is I can cook and I can drive. I might not be a great cook. I might not be a great driver, but I can do both.
People say some of the dumbest things. Like, I'll be at the grocery store loading the groceries into my car, and people like, and then I go to get my car. I'm like, well, do you need help in your car? It's like, well, I wouldn't have come to the grocery store if I couldn't get back in my car.
I've gone up to people and start talking.
I had to stop. I wanted desperately to show you what he says.
That was Maris, wasn't it? Where will you be tomorrow morning?
The jail.
Now we're gonna have to look at this.
It's alright.
I don't want to touch anything.
Yeah. Serenity now, right? We'll get to that too. So that was my first of the what I refer to as the human illusions. And this is I thought a wonderful image of the illusion of strength. We have a guy who is, by any objective measurement, weak. His legs do not work. It takes him that long to even change his shorts, and yet he and his other wheelchair rugby players are determined to show that they're strong. And I'm not, I have to be careful with that particular clip because I don't want to claim in some way that they're not strong. Because certainly in certain ways they are. But I had to stop the clip because I wasn't able to get my bleeps in place soon enough. But the last person that you see says that he actually goes up to people to pick fights. And then when they hesitate to hit him back, he says, "What, you won't hit a kid in a chair? I'll hit you back." So he's even actively going out to prove his strength. Because he, the real estate agent, he cannot bear to be seen as weak. And again, this is, like we were saying earlier, this is not unique to people who are in wheelchairs. This is my life. I cannot, when we were, when I was here at like 10:58 and there were only 3 people in this room, I was like, oh my God, nobody wants to come to this thing. I can't bear to be, weak. I can't live with myself if I might be seen as weak, and so maybe I don't go pick fights because then I look even weaker. Maybe I'll start working out. But again, it's simply an impediment. It ends up as an impediment to coming into contact with that which is gracious, which is offered to the weak. I say that we, as humans, we don't know how to receive good gifts. We try to become the kind of people for whom the gift does not seem so outrageous. We want to say, well, I deserve that in some way. At least in retrospect. At least I've proleptically earned it. Something. I don't know what that word means. But so our first human illusion is one of strength. We exude, we try to show strength because we're terrified that our weakness will leak out, when really what it is that we're trying to hide is the very thing that accesses the grace of God. We're getting down to the end of our time. It's 12. We have until 12:15, right?
Lunch is 12:15, yeah.
Lunch is 12:15. Right, well, let's rock and roll. I'm assuming that if you're not shouting out or raising hands, you're okay. Is everybody familiar with Frasier? If not, this one will take a little introduction. Yes? No? This is Niles and his wife, Daphne. Niles has an ex-wife, Maris, who has recently been accused of murder. And it is revealed that she murdered who she did with a gift from Niles. So he is sort of falling under some kind of suspicion. So that... Okay, the space bar thing is a lie.
I said I tried to visit her.
Have you lost your bloody mind? I have tried to be patient, but this is too much. You promised me that woman would be out of our lives. Now she's calling every minute. The papers report it as though you two are still married, and I can't even sleep in my own bed.
I know, darling, but you can't blame me for everything that's happened.
The hell I can't. If you hadn't snuck off to have lunch with her, we never would have been dragged into this, and you wouldn't be sleeping alone on the couch tonight. But you did, and we were, so you are. I hate that kind of cracker.
It's kind of harsh. Honestly, these are imported from Belgium. Poor thing. She's overtired, a little hormonal. I'll go try to talk her into choosing to be calm. That's right. We're holding up well. A little too well. I'm starting to fear he's not dealing with his emotions at all.
Right. That's the whole secret to holding up.
Dad, it's called repression, and it is not healthy. The man is a walking pressure cooker. It's senior year all over again.
What are you talking about?
Oh, that's right. He's sworn to secrecy. Well. Niles got mono. He missed 4 weeks of class, right? So, he was studying around the clock, trying to catch up. Just before finals, his girlfriend dumped him for his roommate. Niles insisted he was just fine, right up until the very moment when they found him in the all-night grocery, sitting in the freezer bin, talking to a bag of frozen corn, whispering, "Why so cold, my love?" "Oh, calm."
Can help you make up the couch?
No, I can manage.
Okay, well, I think I'll hit the rack too.
Sharing? No?
Oh, how lovely. Thank you.
To the balcony.
After you. Miles.
Well, I admire your initial fortitude. I can't help thinking you may have taken things to extremes. As you know, it can be dangerous to repress one's emotions.
True, but there is no way of weathering a situation like this without a certain degree of detachment.
Are you sure you're not too detached?
Oh, nonsense. Everything's under control.
Oh, look at that.
What in the hell?
Just a news chopper. Pay it no mind.
And it doesn't bother you.
You'll get used to it.
Alpha, heaven, sake, get it off.
Cappuccino, please. And one for him. You don't look so good.
Oh, didn't get much sleep last night. Again.
I'm surprised you're here after yesterday.
I refuse to be cowed into changing my routine. Let me get this. I have my coffee. I go to work. Of course, all my patients want to talk about is Maris. Esteban's crazed brother left me a message saying I owe him some sort of blood debt. Some days it just doesn't pay to get off the sofa.
He's had it pretty rough.
What are my choices? I can go to pieces or I can bear up and live my normal life. Can I get a straw, please?
Oh, sorry, sir. That was the last one.
I see. The last straw. Gosh, is it warm in here? It is. It's warm in here. Oh, suffocating. That's better.
I'll get you a straw now. Do you need a straw?
No, no, no. You heard it. There are no more straws. Oh, that feels so much better. Oh, everything was just so tight before. Ah, yes. Oh. Coffee shop without a straw. It makes no sense.
I can borrow my straw, see?
Oh, this is great. I was being smothered. Oh, I can breathe. I don't know how you stand it.
Brazier, it's me. How close are you to the cafe? All right, well, hurry up and park, because Niles is almost complete. Niles is completely naked. Oh, Niles.
So this fits pretty well into what we were talking about upstairs, right? The whole choosing to be calm. We can choose for a while maybe to appear calm. But choosing what to be is a little more difficult. This is the illusion of control. The illusion that we can, through the force of our will, free or not, determine how things are going to be or how they're going to end up. I mean, I think that the easiest argument for an unfree will is to tell somebody who's not in a good mood to get into one. There's no surer way to get punished. I say, just lighten up. That always works, right? Just tell somebody, hey, on your marriage.
The name of that episode?
Oh, that's right. I think I actually know it. It's the episode is Murder Most Maris. That's in the last season, I think.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time. I did want to I have a couple of things that we're not going to get to. I have one that's sort of my favorite one that I want to show you. It's sort of a tragically underseen film called The Weatherman. Which I highly recommend to everyone. Let me get to it. I should introduce it, yes, since I said it's tragically underseen. Nicolas Cage plays a weatherman whose life is sort of falling apart. He is divorced and sort of estranged from his ex-wife and kids. He's trying to get a big weatherman job in New York City, and that's where we enter.
Hello?
Hello, Dave?
What?
It's Mark Durst from Hello America.
Very nice.
Noreen, I got offered your show, Hello America, with Brian Gumbel.
Well, that's great. Are you gonna take it?
I'm thinking about it. It's a pretty substantial salary, and you know the venue. It's big.
It's a pretty big salary jump, I guess.
$1.2 million all in, Noreen. Can we think about that?
What?
What that kind of change could be like for everybody. Mike, Shelley, you know. If we thought about trying again.
Dave, I'm marrying Russ.
Accuracy equals focusing on a point. Gravity pulls an inch of yard. You plane up. But you have to factor in wind, which is the most difficult part.
Achieved the thing. He has been offered the job that he thinks will fix everything. He has become, I guess, the best weatherman he could be. He has the acclamation. Even Brian Gumbel, of all people, recognizes his skill. And yet, even at his peak, at his most successful, what we in the Christian world might view as an analog, at our most mature, at our most Christian-y, when we're having our best quiet times ever, he is brought low. To the point of considering murder, he is not only lowered a few rungs, but lowered to the bottom. There is no space between the top of the ladder and the bottom. We are always on the last rung. If the image of the Christian spiritual journey is the image of climbing a ladder, which it's not. But if you were to use that image, you could envision that the ladder that is underneath you is constantly vanishing as you climb. So that you're on the last rung at all times. Always one thing from falling off, from going from success and thinking that this is the thing that'll fix everything. You know, this is the thing I hate most about God. That it seems to be his business to destroy the idols in our lives, which really hurts. That we think that if I can just do this, then everything will be okay. As soon as I got my car fixed, you know, the radiator in my living room started leaking. And there's never an end, and I always think that it's God destroying my idol of self-sufficiency, which I'm apparently very attached to since I keep recarving it every time. But this is such a profound example because you can't imagine that a man who's just been offered the thing he's always wanted can be brought to this point in 2 minutes. And yet, as unbelievable as it would seem, somehow this film makes it believable. It seems so real and so true that we are never far from the bottom of that ladder. I think it was John Zoll who said, I don't know if he was quoting somebody else or not, I'll attribute it to him, but he said that God's office is at the end of your rope. And I like that. You know, he may have other offices elsewhere, But the office that's important to me is the one that's at the end of my rope. And this, I thought, was a powerful clip, sort of just showing how close we always are to the end of our rope. That no matter how far up that gym rope we've climbed, we're never far from God's office, which is, in the end, the good news. That though we're always at the bottom of the ladder, though we're always at the end of our rope, that's where God is. That's where he works. He uses people like us to do his work. He chooses the foolish things in the world to shame the wise, the weak, to shame the strong. Chooses the things that are not. The things that are not to call into question the things that are. And I just think that good movies that are about real life, or that have something to say about humanity and are honest about it, like this, can help us to see things about ourselves and help others to see things about themselves in accessible ways that, you know, sometimes theological articles are. I mean, it's just another way in. It's just another window in the house. And inside is the gospel, and that's the important thing. And we're just looking for ways in. And this is one of my ways in, and there's lots of other ways in. I hope that, I don't know, at least this has been fun. We're going to, I think, try to put either the clips online or the references online. I'm certainly able to tell you what the films were.
I don't think you can legally put the clips online.
Don't bring the law in.
Seriously.